Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello and welcome to today's program on the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is the third in the three-part series on self-publishing. Our program tonight is book sales and marketing. This is the final program in our series. I would like to let you know also there's a great program tomorrow night, Living a Slow, Rich Life, a different kind of lesson from Japan that'll be in this same room tomorrow night at 6 p.m. So, in the meantime, I would like to introduce our moderator, and she will introduce the program. Our moderator is Paula Hendricks. I really want to thank her. Paula and I put this series together, and Paula has done an amazing job of gathering everyone for the last 3 weeks, and just I'm really, really appreciative of what she's done, and I think you guys are too. Just to tell you her official background, Paula Hendricks is founder and book designer of Cinnabar Bridge Communications and author of September in Corrales and co-author of the Tire House book. And so with that, please welcome Paula Hendricks.
Thank you very much. And welcome. As Kevin said, this is our final event. It's nice to see some of you have been at one or both of the other events. And tonight we're going to be talking about book sales and marketing. There are some handouts over here, so please feel free to get them after the program. We have a great panel tonight, and I'm going to give each of them about 5 minutes to talk about some aspect of sales and marketing. They're going to also tell you a little bit about their book, because different kinds of books have different ways of marketing them. So that'll happen here in a minute. And as Kevin said, we've set aside some time at the end for your questions. Last week, an article in Publishers Weekly stated that there were more than 764,000 self-published or micro-niche titles published in the U.S. in 2009. 764,000. Now, not all of those, something over 600,000 were backlist, out-of-print books, that kind of thing, which is a whole other conversation about the long tail and how your books never have to go out of print. But that is an enormous number of books being published in a year. To give you perspective, traditional publishers published under 300,000 books, and their percentage of the total keeps going down every year. So what does this mean to you? This means that it's more important than ever to figure out how to get people's attention and to buy your book. So that's what we're here to talk about tonight. How do you break through the noise? I know these guys are going to talk about how you make choices, because you can say, oh, yeah, I've got to do that. Oh, yeah, I've got to do that. I've got to do all these 15 or 1,500 things. Can't do it. You got to make some choices. So we've got folks here are going to give you a perspective on what's worked for them, and hopefully you will come away with some ideas about what will work for you. So we're going to start off with Elizabeth Block. Elizabeth is the author of a novel, A Gesture Through Time. She's the recipient of a Christopher Isherwood Foundation Fiction Fellowship. So Elizabeth, you're going to talk to us, I think, about how you got your book into the bricks and mortar bookstores and what you did to make that happen. Take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Paula. And thank you, everybody, for coming. It's a pleasure to be here and speak at the Commonwealth Club. First, I just wanted to say something lead into my discussion that Paula curating this series is quite novel and quite brave in itself, because in the literary and publishing traditions and worlds, self-publishing has historically been very taboo and a bad word. And whereas if you look into the film industry or the music industry, self-producing is very de rigueur and very chic and very hip. And now, in some ways, we've come full circle, and there are more opportunities for authors to have the same kind of opportunities and ways to launch their careers that visual artists have had and been encouraged to do. And I think that's really important, and it's really important to have venues such as the Commonwealth Club sort of recognize and honor that those new options. And so for me, I had a book, a novel that is considered, has been considered and has been reviewed as an avant-garde sort of fine art literary novel, and I knew that would make it very hard for me to get published. But I was, I've been writing my whole life, and I was determined to not let anything stand in my way. And I knew that would take a lot of energy and around-the-clock working, and it didn't matter whether or not I had to pay the rent with another job or whatever I had to do. I knew this would have to take up every space of me. So I was willing to put everything on the line for it, and I did. And so I found a fine art press in New York who was willing to work with me and to give me a lot of freedom to do what I wanted to do with the book. And including, I have a textbook within a text flip book within the novel. So it's kind of, I'm doing different layers with the novel in itself. But what I had to do was, the publisher published the book essentially. He advertised on his website. He sent the book out, the press releases out to libraries for potential purchase. He arranged one initial book launch reading, and he put one ad in Book Forum, which is a quarterly book review journal, which is a really wonderful journal. And that's quite a lot for an independent literary fine art press. And so I was very fortunate to have that. But then what I had to do, what I became very aware of, is that A, if I don't hustle this book and get it into the bookstores, maybe the book won't even get out there into the bookstores unless I already have things lined up in advance. So I became very aware of that cat and mouse game that was sort of starting to play out with my publisher, and plays out with a lot of, I think, small press publishers who want to see what the interest is before they'll actually put the books out. So I promptly just went through every possible venue I could get to, be it a conventional bookstore, a fine art venue, or an alternative reading series. And through I worked through my contacts and also just my experience, and I'm also actually a filmmaker, so I've had a lot of interface with those other worlds. So I sort of cultivated as much as I could from all worlds, and I also went to the bookstores that I knew of, that were my favorite bookstores, and I targeted across the country every place that I could possibly target. And some people weren't interested at all, and others, just by pitching the basic, you know, story, they were very interested, and they immediately booked me. I followed up. I persisted. I didn't stop. I mean, nothing would stop me. And that's the bottom line, is that I had that sort of blind determination. It was, you know, it was blind. It was naive in many ways, but it did something for me. And so I ended up doing a 16-city book tour in really wonderful bookstores and wonderful venues. So I was able to read at places like Elliott Bay Books in Seattle, which is fantastic. I read at Shaman Drum Bookstore in Ann Arbor, which is an incredible bookstore. I read at City Lights. They did a good launch for me, City Lights. The Bowery Poetry Club in New York. I read at this very interesting place called the Discreet Reading Series in Chicago. All of these kinds of venues that kept pushing me through and getting the book out there and getting it in the hands of people, really in an old-fashioned way. And that's one thing I did. I did a lot of that kind of stuff till it led to radio appearances and blog appearances. And this came out in 2006, so it was before social networking, so I really hadn't done that. But one of the other things I also did, really on the bricks and mortar level, is that I had these pens made with the title of the book, and you know, and so I'd leave them wherever I went, and just anywhere I could, and I'd give them to people in the audience, and I brought plenty, so you're all welcome to have some pens. any little thing I could do, I did, and I believe that it made a difference for somebody, you know, this unknown young writer who worked on this sort of quote avant-garde press, which, you know, some people are offended by that or they're turned off by that, and I can understand that because some write, you know, but I didn't want it to be that stereotype of that author who gets published on that press and becomes this sort of reserved in this academic world, and because that's not for me. But so I tried to straddle both worlds, you know, promoting, but while being on this fine art press, and so, you know, so I would do whatever I could, and these real little bricks and mortar things really paved the way, and I built an audience that way. You know, I'm not a best-selling author, but I built an audience of a loyal following. I got reviewed in very interesting venues. I didn't get one bad review, which was really lovely. I didn't get reviewed in Publishers Weekly, but that's okay. But I was able to go on, and I've published since with Penguin Press. So I've been able to it's catapulted many things, and as Paula was saying, I've received awards for the writing as a result. And I just it's just that sort of passion and that determination and in some ways that blindness in a way. And you know, now I have a toddler who just turned two, so I've been sort of, you know, pulled away for a while, but actually that's, I think, will give me a different perspective when I sort of plunge back in. But I think it's really important to, depending on what kind of work you're doing, to give yourself that permission to promote yourself and to do what you need to do. And even if it goes against the grain of the traditions of publishing. How am I doing with time here? I just persisted, and I was very blessed and fortunate, and I got to meet some wonderful people through the process, and I'm continually learning, and there's always more, it's always changing, and now, you know, as you go, but I feel like you just really have to make a decision that that you want to do this thing, and find the avenue that's best for you, and really just go for it, and understand that it's a very, very difficult road. But if you persist, something will happen, and you can't control everything, and you have to sort of let go at a certain level. But you do what you can do, and you try to find what works for you, because it's a very stressful business too. And if you don't find what works for you, it won't work. So it has to be about what your temperament and you can find suitable.
I think that's really true. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Scott James will be speaking next. And Scott is a columnist for the New York Times. And he is the novelist Kemble Scott and the author of Soma and The Sower. So, Scott, you're going to talk about, I think, the experiments you've tried and how it all worked, you know, with Scribd and indie stores and that kind of thing. So,
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for everyone coming out tonight. So you're probably thinking, well, this is the New York Times guy, and so he's kind of a big shot, and I'm not a big shot, and he's got, you know, the jump on everybody else because he works for the New York Times. Well, I will tell you that everything I'm going to talk about tonight with regard to my novels happened well before I started working for the New York Times, and in fact, I got the job with the New York Times because of my work writing these novels. My first novel is called Soma. It's kind of a Tales of the City type book set here in South of Market, which is where you are right now. In fact, a lot of the scenes in the book take place within a few blocks of the Commonwealth Club. But it's fair to say the story's a little edgy. It's about the parts of the city that you don't find in the Lonely Planet. So it's a little adult, let's put it that way. So the first book was published by a traditional publisher, Kensington Press, out of New York City. I did sell the book on my own without an agent, and we can talk about that later if you'd like to know about that route, because that's kind of an end run around the usual process. But basically, that came out the usual way, and it actually did fairly well. And the reason it did well was because of an experiment. First of all, I started out, I wasn't a known person, I wasn't a successful author already, and I was not a celebrity and had no platform. So as the book was coming out, I was trying to figure out, well, how do you launch a book and how do you make it successful? And I had the checklist of all the things that people do. They go to, you know, bookstores and they do readings and they try to get, you know, reviews. But a lot of people get that, and it doesn't mean that the books will ultimately be successful. And I was talking to a friend, actually my downstairs neighbor, and she worked in marketing, and she said, well, what are you doing to make sure that this book is a bestseller? And I said, well, I'm doing all of these things. And she said, well, does that guarantee it will be a bestseller? And I said, no, it doesn't, because everyone does these things. So she said, why don't you do something with my company, this company I'm working for? Well, she had quit her job as a PR person and had gone to work for a .com. Now, at the time, this is around 2006, .com, that was a real stinker. You know, nobody worked in .com anymore. It was such a bust. People were still angry about the bubble bursting. But this woman, she just had this idea and met these guys and thought that they had a terrific company and she was going to go to work for them. So she quit her PR job and all her friends said she was crazy to do it. Well, the company turned out to be YouTube. Right. Who's laughing now? And so when she said do something with my company, she meant do some videos. Well, I'd worked in television news earlier in my career, and so I knew a little bit about putting together videos. And so I thought that would be okay to do. And I said to her, what should I make? And she said, well, that's really your problem. We don't really know. We just started this thing. So she did have some guidelines, and we can talk about those if you do want to use YouTube. So it turned out that I was the first author to launch a novel using YouTube. This actually got me some press. Actually, it was a tech press, not the New York Times Book Review. It was a technology bloggers, one in particular called ValleyWag. Does anyone here work in tech and has heard of ValleyWag? Well, ValleyWag is kind of the gossip, snarky blog of the tech world. And so they did what they do, which is they flamed me. So it's actually a badge of honor if you're in the tech world to be flamed by ValleyWag. Well, they flamed me. And they pointed out that my videos were just so G-rated compared to the content of the novel. Well, this got a lot of people interested in the novel. And so the first week the book came out, it was on the bestsellers list, going from nowhere to somewhere. And in fact, the book sold out immediately. This is the San Francisco Chronicle bestsellers list. This is this area. It sold out, and I found out that it actually takes 2 to 3 weeks for a book to be restocked when it sells out. And then I got on the list again when it was you could finally buy it again. So it was a really good start because I tried something different. And in doing the YouTube videos, well, we can talk a little bit later about how to do them particularly if you want to do it. But my experience as a television professional actually worked against me in constructing those videos because I had, you know, had in mind big production and you know, HD quality and all that stuff. And I learned very quickly that if you want to communicate on YouTube, it's a much more intimate experience. And we'll talk about that later and how you can do that. And I'll tell you actually a story that's much better than mine, a success story, a woman named Kelly Corrigan who's done it better than I ever could. So for my second novel, I actually was writing it, and kind of a weird thing happened where I was looking for blurbs. One of the things that you want to do if you're an aspiring writer, if you can, is before you submit the book anywhere, try to get blurbs from people who are related to the book in the field or authors or some sort of endorsement. Why do you want to do that? Because in the world of media, not just publishing, but especially publishing, nobody wants to make a decision on their own. It's really good if you come to the table and say, I got 10 other people who think this is a great book, and they're not related to me. They're actually people you may have heard of. So go and get blurbs if you can when you're still in manuscript form. Make sure you got a good manuscript, but try to get blurbs. So I had sent my manuscript to this author who I thought would like it and would give me a blurb. Well, he really liked the book. It's this book here. It's called The Sower. He liked it so much that he took the manuscript on his own without asking me to his publisher in New York, plopped it on the guy's desk, and said, this is your next bestseller. Very dramatic. A week later, I get a phone call out of the blue from a publisher in New York saying, we want to publish your second novel. And I said, who is this? I'd never submitted the book anywhere. I never even had it agented at that point. So you say to yourself, wow, what a great story. It's like Hollywood. It's like being discovered on a diner stool or something. Well, it didn't exactly work out. I met with the people in New York, and they made an offer on the book. They sent me the contract, and it was a terrible contract. It was like a contract that they signed for American Idol or something. They wanted a piece of everything I ever wrote from that day forward as part of the deal. It was a terrible deal that no one should ever sign. And so I said to them, I can't sign this contract. It's not at all industry standard. It's not at all appropriate. And the guy, turned out that the people had never vetted me before making an offer. They did not know that I was previously published, that my first book was a bestseller. All they knew was the book. So they got very upset when I said I wasn't going to sign the contract and actually rescinded the offer because I was not being cooperative and said I was not the person they thought I was. So apparently I wasn't stupid. So at that time I was very, like, you know, you can imagine I was kind of down on the whole publishing experience. Here I had this thing happen. The first book is a bestseller. The second one gets an offer before it's even been submitted. And then I got a phone call from people at a company called Scribd. Scribd is actually located here in San Francisco. It is what's considered the YouTube of documents. You can actually upload any sort of document, and no matter where you are in the world, you can read that document. Whether it was put up in Word, you don't have to have Word, you don't have to have any sort of, you know, software to read documents, and you can put it in, they format it in a little screen like a book, and you can read it on your laptop or your desktop. You can be basically a publisher. Now, I had never heard of Scribd, even though it has 50 million unique users per month. Think of that. But the reason I had never heard of them is that most of them are younger, college-age kids. So basically, they were looking to get into the book business, and they were going to sell books. And they had figured out a way to actually sell e-books online using this vast empire that they had created. And so I listened to what they had to say, and I thought, well, you know what? Why don't we do The Sower that way for its first release? What do I have to lose? If I sell books, great. If nothing happens, then I'm back to square one. I'll have to go through the usual submissions list. Well, it turned out actually to be quite an adventure working with Scribd, because my book became the first novel that they sold. And immediately I was all of a sudden in the New York Times, the London Times, the LA Times. I was all over the world with this book because I'd gone from being this traditionally published author to trying this experiment in ebooks. Now, we'll talk about Scribd, we'll talk about ebooks, and we'll talk about the promise and the limitations. The way I like to talk about Scribd is that they built the gas station before cars were invented. And right now is when we're seeing the cars, like the iPad and the Kindle, opening up to all sorts of other documents. We're seeing the cars actually hit the road and the opportunity for authors to reach out to readers. But it was a great experience. I mean, it got a lot of publicity. And immediately I had people ask me if I would put the book into print. I ended up working with a boutique publisher in up in San Rafael, Numina Press. What intrigued me about the publisher was that she only does a few titles a year. And she said, you know, I can actually get this into stores very quickly. How quickly? Between the time that I signed the contract with Numina to the day it was in the stores, it was 29 days start to finish, and there was a hardcover. We actually did an initial launch, a limited edition hardcover. We actually have some copies for sale here tonight, and they were only for sale at independent bookstores. So that was our approach. And I'm happy to say, sure enough, it made it onto the bestsellers list the first week it was out, partially because all the buzz about the book and how it came to be. The book itself, I have to tell you, is also a little adult. The premise of the novel is, and I'll give you my 15-second elevator pitch, and you all better have those if you're writing books, is that an oil worker is accidentally infected with a man-made supervirus. But instead of making people sick, the virus cures all diseases, cancer, the common cold, anything. But the catch is, the only way to pass this miracle cure to others is through sex. And so thus begins a kind of thriller that goes around the world, because he all of a sudden, one day, is basically, when the word gets out that he has this and he's the sole carrier, he becomes the most wanted man on the planet. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you very much. Teresa Leung Ryan is the author of Love Made of Heart and Build Your Name, Beat the Game, Be Happily Published. Teresa, you've written a memoir as well as a writer's workbook. Tell us what you're doing for your books and how the audience.
First of all, thank you, Paula and Kevin, for creating the series, and I heard that Michael Larson was instigator.
Yes. I think Michael Larson was one of the key players as well.
I'm so happy to be up here with Elizabeth and Scott. So my, it's actually a novel because I felt that I could tell the truth by transforming a memoir into a novel and letting my protagonists tell the story. So 20 years ago, I had a dream. And that dream was to touch readers someday the way that Maxine Hong Kingston touched me with Woman Warrior, the way that E.B. White touched me with Charlotte's Web. So 20 years ago, so the journey began, writing and rewriting, meeting with my critique group twice a month. What else? Meeting the archetypes in the industry. The archetypes, right? The allies, the villains, the gatekeepers, shapeshifters, the tricksters, the hero who had a big dream and really didn't know where to go. So fast forward, it's now 1997, a friend who was not a writer sends me a brochure to the Jack London Writers Conference. So I entered their contest and I walked away with second prize in novel category. So I thought, ah, this is it. You know, I got this award and I could pitch myself to agents and by next week I'm going to be someone's author, right? Not at all. The manuscript was not ready, didn't have a front story, according to Martha Alderson, who has now become a very dear friend. She teaches writers how to plot their books. So then more pitching to agents, and, you know, that's a different story altogether.
It's a different topic.
Finding agents and then having the publisher find the agent and find you. So I consider myself a very lucky author because I have lots of mentors, colleagues, supportive family, husband who's always rooting for me, friends, who said this one magic word to me over and over, persevere, persevere. As a matter of fact, an agent who rejected me used that word on me and said, you know, Teresa, if you hang in this industry for 3 years, you're going to make it. And she was right. So now it's 1999, and my mom is dying at the San Francisco Zen Hospice, and I get a phone call from an agent that I had pitched to who says, Teresa, I found a gem in the slush pile, and that gem was Love Made of Heart. So my point is, you know, even during the highlights of one's career, life goes on, and sometimes there's actually tragedy while you're receiving really fabulous news about your career. So fast forward again, Kensington, Scott's publisher, we have the same editor, John, they found me through my agent. And when you are represented by a big publisher, you're competing with fellow authors in that house. So with Kensington, they release about 500 new titles a year. So, you know, there are only 365 days in a year, right? So the magic number for publishers, for big publishers, is 6 weeks. You have 6 weeks to build your platform. Now, of course, you're thinking, well, it's 18 months from the day that a publisher offers you a contract to the day when the book actually hits the street. So you have 18 months to build your career, but not really, because you're supposed to be writing your next book, right? And then when the book comes out, you have 6 weeks, because 6 weeks is when the publishers will buy the table space, the shelf space, cover, what is this called, Scott? Face out. Everything publishers have to pay for. when your book is lucky enough to be distributed through bookstores.
I should say it, you pay for it whether you're self-published or traditionally published.
That's right.
That's right.
Yes.
And a lot of self-publishers
don't. Someone has
to pay
for that real estate
space. Right,
you
do. Yeah.
So that was 2002 when the hardcover came out, and then the trade paperback came out a year later. Now, again, I am a really lucky person. I don't know who nominated the novel so that now it's archived in the San Francisco History Center. I don't know who the teachers were who picked up the book and started using them in high schools and colleges and universities. So since...
What did you do to make this
I think it was
sell?
Knowing what my mission statement is.
Okay.
You know, thanks, Paula. Mm-hmm. It was knowing what my mission statement is so that to the point where booksellers and teachers could paraphrase it. And that is, I use love made of heart to shed light on the secret agonies of mothers and daughters mm-hmm. in domestic violence.
Mm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because when I didn't know what the mission statement is and I would call up a bookstore and want to read at a bookstore, the answer was, thank you, congratulations on being a new author, but we invite only best-selling authors. But as soon as I knew what the book was about and knew how to articulate it, then I received the invitations. And also, I started receiving invitations to speak at community events, like during April, Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month, or to talk about domestic violence in schools, and also mental illness. So the last 2 years, I am wearing another hat. I am now a writing career coach, which is I help my clients build their names. I help them identify their mission statements, so that they can build their names while they're writing. Because now, and I'm sure Elizabeth and Scott and Paula will agree with me, that it's a fine dance between writing and building one's name.
Yeah.
It is so competitive now that even if you find the right agent and your agent will pitch you to publishers, guess what the question will be from the publisher's sales department? What kind of platform does he have? How big is her fan base? And, you know, we're all competing with celebrity authors. And I have found ways, and so have my colleagues, we have found ways to compete with celebrity authors. And that is by really knowing who you are, what you stand for, what you're passionate about, and be able to articulate all that to your fans. And your fans start with your friends and colleagues. It starts with as simple as putting your quote or your mission statement on your emails. You don't always have a signature block. My close friends will just say, you know, whatever. Have a great day, Yolanda. I'll pick on Yolanda, right? But it's like, Yolanda, I need to know what your mission statement is so that I could help promote you. By the way, it's Yolanda Berrio.
So, Scott and Elizabeth, do you agree with that? That's the mission statement, the making of your novel or your fiction, sort of a nonfiction platform. How do you build that community or the fan base?
Well, I can talk, you know, one of the tricks to promoting a novel. How many people are working on novels? Fiction? Some? Most people are working on nonfiction?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nonfiction?
I think nonfiction actually is easier to promote and market because it's your story or you're an expert in it. And in fact, the news media world likes experts, likes to use them. I like to use them. I think that that's really important. There's a usefulness there. When you're pitching a novel, it's a little bit different because basically the answer to every question is kind of the same, which is, yeah, I made that up. Yeah, I made that up too. So you want to, if you are writing fiction, you want to find the narrow part of the story that you can get into in a non-fictiony way. So for my first novel, Soma, which is set here in San Francisco, it was inspired by the real-life craziness of the San Francisco Underground. So when I made those YouTube videos, what I did was I took viewers to the places that inspired the novel. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one, because it's right here at the end of the block. There's a hotel. It used to be called the Argent Hotel. Now I think it's a Westin. And it's a scene in the book because it's a favorite destination for people who are interested in a certain type of activity. It's because this hotel has floor-to-ceiling windows. So when you have the curtains open, everybody on the outside can see everything happening on the inside of your room, especially at night. And this has a certain appeal to people who like to show off their personal lives. So there's a chapter in the book about that. And so for the video, I actually shot a little two-minute story about this weird little thing that you would never notice unless I tell you to look. And so people, you know, if you stand in Buena Vista, Herba Buena Park, is it? You can actually turn around and look at the hotel, and it's like a 100 little TV screens. And at night, you can actually see what I'm talking about in the book. So to do that piece, that's like a two-minute clip, basically taking a real-life thing and saying you can see this, and it inspired a scene in the book and what happens to one of the characters. So find that narrow nonfiction way in to talk about, have a talking point about your novel.
Right. I think that's right. I think that's what you did with your book with domestic violence and that kind of thing. It gave people this sort of reality-based thing to make it news in ways other than just your novel. Elizabeth, do you have something to maybe add to that?
Yeah, I would say I took a different
lean approach. Towards the mic.
I took a different approach. There's some overlap, mine was very much about the formal issues of the book and the form my book took and the way it. I wanted to reach out to particular audiences that I already had access to and that I was already conversant with through other works, shorter works that had been published, but also, as I said, I was working as a filmmaker at the time, too, and screening short films pretty extensively while all of this was happening. So, and I also worked with a composer and did other kind of audio media interaction, too, so that there were multi-layers going on, and it wasn't about YouTube. It was outside of the commercial realm. This book was very much outside of the commercial realm, actually, and that's why I'm sort of astonished it did as well as it did. But that says, like, as I said, I really pushed it. But it was really about stressing the different forms I was engaging and an audience I already sort of had been in conversation with, and also this multimedia platform, which was discussed a little bit here. But I didn't really take a conventional approach to a mission statement or a platform, although I think I would definitely do that the next time around to reach out to a different audience. But I was very much, I was very much into this rebelliousness about the commercialism, and also wanting to really be innovative, if that's even possible. And I don't think it really is ultimately, but then it is as well. I mean, it's a complicated issue, but so it became just a more of a formal question for me, I think.
So talk to me about the kind of effort it takes. In other words, there's money involved, which some of you spent some money on and maybe you didn't spend money on others. But when I'm listening to you, what I'm hearing is time and energy, and I've heard perseverance. I've heard hustle. I've heard, just keep at it. Try all things. In other words, I think the reality is that the big publishers have an advantage a little bit with distribution and sometimes with things like access to big media, but they don't have an advantage in the one-on-one contact. In other words, the author and the reader. That mm-hmm. can be done by anybody, whether you're traditionally published or not. So talk about the effort of that and the money of that. In other words, I look at all the options and think, oh my gosh, if I do what I'm hearing, I won't have time to breathe, let alone write, let alone... So just jump in.
I'll start by talking about the money. First of all, I think that spending a lot of money is irrelevant to whether or not you're going to be successful in promoting your book. And I'll tell you why. Books do not sell in the traditional advertising manner. There's a reason why you don't see 30-second spots during the Super Bowl for a book. That's not how books are sold. That's not how we get intrigued about books. Think about the last book that you read. And did somebody really market it to you on the back of a cereal box, or did somebody most likely say, hey, I read this book, it's fantastic, I think you'll like it, or you read a review? There's a certain buzz that goes along that's more person to person. They like to say that books sell by word of mouth rather than by traditional advertising. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure you're thinking, well, wait a minute, did I see a full-page ad for Stephen King? Don't look at the blockbusters and say that that's how it works. Those people just need to have their base fans reminded that a new book is coming out, and that sells it. For the rest of us, it's a different approach, and I think money actually hurts. And I'll continue with my YouTube example as an example of why I think that. So on these videos that I made, the first try, because I'd worked in television, I called a friend who had a fancy HD camera, and this is back in 2006 when HD wasn't so easily available. And she shot a beautiful thing in full color panorama. Could have gone up in a, you know, in a movie studio, in a movie theater. And when I screened it, I realized it was all wrong. It was completely overproduced. If you're talking about a video for online to promote your book, think about how you watch videos online. It's called YouTube. It's between you and someone else. It's a very personal experience, usually one-on-one. One person looking at the screen and your information they're looking at. It is not a performance. It is not theater. It does not have to be grand in order to make its point. So, in fact, with that first footage, I threw it all out, and we started over. And I said thanks, but no thanks, to my friend, the cinematographer, and I got a $600 digital camera and got a friend who had never shot anything in his life and said, you're shooting this. And it's filled with shaky shots and out of focus and bad zooms and the whole thing, and it is perfect because this was about me, the author, trying to relate to you, the reader, on a one-on-one level. So it's personal. So the better example is Kelly Corrigan, who wrote a book called The Middle Place, which I believe is something having to do with related to cancer, the book. What she did was, and this is not cynical marketing, she just did this, and here's what happened. She has a video online where she reads an essay that she wrote off of a piece of paper in someone's backyard with a bunch of women sitting in lawn chairs. It could not be less produced as a video. But what she says in this essay is really important, and it's really relevant. And the women who watch it, it's about women and their relationships with one another, they take it and they pass that link to 20 of their best friends. 4 million people have watched that video. So it wasn't about spending a lot of money. It was about having the right message and what it is you're trying to say. Now, when approaching media, and I know a little bit about this because of my work in TV news and also for the newspaper, but basically there are three ways you get people's attention. This is what, how we think in the news business. So think about this and apply it to your own book. It has to be either new, brand new, never heard it before. So September 11th, that never happened before. So you understand how big it is to have something brand new that has never happened before in the world and how people become, you know, obsessed by it. Number two, a way to get into hook people's attention is it relevant? It's going to rain tomorrow. Your taxes are going up. Well, that impacts my life. That's relevant to me. And the third way that we in the news business think about what makes for a good story is a kind of a gee whiz factor. Probably my little story about the Argent Hotel has you being thinking of it as a gee whiz thing. Although for some of you, it might be very relevant. But the point is that it's going to be one of those three hooks that you're going to have to come up with for your book. Ideally, it would be great if it was all three. And that's how you have to think how to pitch to either in a YouTube video or blog or even to media.
I just like to say, but on the other hand, I wanted to say that one does not always have to think only in those commercial terms if one is to seek an audience or find an audience for that matter. I was not interested in, you know, maybe 4 million people. I'm sorry, I'm not quoting you correctly, but let's say 4 million people reading my book. But I was interested in the people that were going to read my book to really be interested in my book and that following to be very sincere and cohesive, and I found that I was fortunate to get that. Also,
I think you worked hard to get it too.
Yes,
I don't think it's all about fortune. I think you made your own luck.
Thank you, thank you. I appreciate that. But the other thing is that I was saying is that, you know, this YouTube thing, and I think it's wonderful, and I think it's great that the publishing world has finally adopted these new approaches to marketing. But it is actually, like I was coming back to my original story, in the film and music worlds, these media platforms have been around before the publishing industry has finally grabbed onto them. And like I said, I was naturally, I'm a filmmaker, and I was naturally doing, actually, you can see some of the abstract sort of excerpts from my film on the cover, but I actually did design the cover, but that's another story with my publisher. But I also, my film stills are also in the book. But the point is that at the time, these things were circulating in a film festival circuit. So that was not through YouTube, and you couldn't click right onto it. You had to be in a film festival audience. And my films are distributed actually on 16 millimeter, so it's this old media. But the work I also did with this composer, but that created a link that was not commercial, but did have multiple audience impacts. And I think that it's great that the publishing industry is finally tapping into that, but it has been slow to tap into that in a way that other industries have not, like the art world, for example, is not based in this whole commercial market system, so that it can tap into these multimedia systems. But it's still new to the publishing world, but it's not a new idea in and of itself. I think the authors such as yourself who have done that successfully have been on the cutting edge in terms of the publishing world, but that stuff has precedence in other art forms.
Look, I'll just follow up a little bit. The publishing industry is actually the big six sisters are actually getting into the business of producing videos to promote books. And they are largely an incredible expensive failure. Because remember what I told you about how that it's a you situation? Mm-hmm. They don't get that. They're producing them like movie trailers that you'd see in the cinema. Mm-hmm. And there are actually websites you can go, I don't know the names of them, where you can look at the companies that produce these on behalf of authors. And they will spend thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, more often than the author is getting it for their advance, on the video to promote the book. Mm-hmm. And take a look at the number of views. There'll be like 112 views. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Remember I told you about Kelly Corrigan and the backyard and the ladies in the folding chairs? Mm-hmm. That video cost nothing to produce, but it was sincere. And I would just disagree with you a little bit. When I was talking about the 3 points of getting into a reader, I think probably your book has those, although you might not think of them in those base terms. And I can tell you that she certainly did not think when she wrote that essay that it was going to be a blockbuster Susan Boyle moment on YouTube. She just had something to say, and I think she was very sincere about it, and she meant it. And there's that thing about the relevance. It had relevance, but it wasn't a cynical marketing ploy.
I think it's time to maybe open this up to questions. Kevin, you want to...
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Okay.
I'd just like to remind our listening audience at home, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight is Self-Publishing, Part 3, third in a series on self-publishing. Our program tonight is Book Sales and Marketing. And now we're going to turn it over for questions from the audience.
Ask us how to do it with fun.
Yes, that's a good one. So questions, please. No questions? Oh, yes. Here they come.
Yeah, this is for Scott. You're talking about getting blurbs before you submit your book. Who would these blurbs be from?
Well, I think that if you can become part of the local writing community, we're very fortunate to be in the Bay Area and have to have so many incredible writers who are here and are accessible to us. Go to their events, go to their readings, go to workshops. You'll connect with these people. The San Francisco Writers Workshop, which is held every Tuesday night since 1946, and a lot of terrific writers have come out of there. Probably the most famous is Khaled Hosseini, who wrote The Kite Runner, in that group. So if you become part of these communities, volunteer for Litquake, you will meet these writers. You will hang out with these writers. You will have a beer after the workshop with these writers. And then you ask them either if they're on point for your book, maybe them directly, or who they might know. Look, I'm not going to kid you. Some people will say, sure, I'd love to give you a blurb, and then they never get it done. It actually is a lot of work to write a blurb. I just did one for an author, and I read the whole book before I blurb it. I know that not everyone does. So you want to be aware that you could do 10 yeses and only 10 queries and only get two that say yes, but that's enough. It doesn't. In fact, if you're in the nonfiction world, if there's an expert in what you're talking about, well, if you're writing about politics and Bill Clinton endorses your book, it's a great blurb. He's more known for being a president than an author, right? So think about that. Think of who are the experts who would actually convince either a publisher or an agent, if you're going to go that route, or a reader to say, oh, well, he's got that endorsement. I'm going to read that book.
And folks, keep in mind, too, that for writers who are writing novels and memoirs, you are the expert of your experiences.
Okay. Don't be afraid to ask somebody famous like Bill Clinton, but don't expect them necessarily to answer. But I've heard of people who wrote to the head of the person in their field thinking, oh, they'll never write me back. They're too busy, and actually got some really great blurbs. So be realistic, but don't not ask. I mean, ask for what you want from the people in your field or the people who you think are going to be relevant, other mystery writers or someone else, and then look for your friends in the community that you're in.
That's right. And ask people who speak your mission statement.
And I think what we're saying here is become part of a community or become part of the community you want to become part of. In other words, this is going to take some effort, one-on-one, personal relationships.
Did you, Scott, did you make money from Scrib directly or just indirectly from the publicity? Because it sounds like a way to give your stuff away for free.
Well, you absolutely can give away your books for free on Scrib. I did make some money on it. I think that the lesson in Scrib and any of these companies right now is this is the beginning of a story. It's a very, very early stage. I probably benefited the most from anyone else because it led to a lot of things happening for me because I was the first. None of you will be the first if you do it because it's already been done. What I think is going to happen is you're going to see Scribd. You're going to see the ability to sell your books directly through Kindle on Amazon, probably through iPad with Steve Jobs and Apple. That's all happening, but that's not happening until now. Literally this month is when, you know, things started to open up. I think the potential is there, but it is only at the very, very beginning. Now, I will say, since we're here to talk about marketing, I have 35,000 people who are following me on Scribd. They call them subscribers. You call them fans on Facebook, whatever. So that's a platform. So that's a marketing platform. So that allows me to tell them I'm going to be at a certain event in your town. Come out and see me if I'm at a bookstore doing a reading. So it does have value. It might not be a cash value immediately that you receive from the sale of a book, but it has other values to it.
Last week we had one of the speakers who does an app, and he sells it for $2, $1.99, and he actually makes more money from the app than he does from his books because the percentages and what goes to the author are significantly different. So he'll get 80% or 70% of the app money, whereas in a book, even if he self-publishes it, because he was traditionally published, self-published, and doing apps, it was in the Scribd kind of thing that he was actually making more money per sale than he was with the other books.
There's an article in today's Galley Cat, that's an industry blog that profiles two or three authors who claim to be making a very good living just selling the ebook editions on Kindle directly in a relationship with Amazon direct to readers, not going through a publisher.
I'd like to take you up on your offer to hear about fun, but I'd also like to take you up on your offer of hearing about fun with some impact, because it's a lot of organizing to get this done. So How do you have fun and create a very powerful impact using not a million dizzy activities?
It's collect advice from colleagues, make a list of them, and say, you know what? I think I will enjoy doing that and that and that. But and I might try this and this, but that can wait. For me, right now, I am in love with blogging. 2 years ago, I was so afraid. I thought, oh, my gosh, I don't have time to blog. But I discover what blogging means to me on cyberspace. Everything that you write is a document, right? Cyberspace is this library of all the documents. How would your fans find you if there is no... Okay, remember, let's go back a little bit. Who remembers going to the library and actually open up catalog card, index cards, okay? Imagine all of us having written books. Nobody has created those catalog cards for us, right? Nowadays, those catalog cards are on cyberspace. They're called tags, right?
Meta tags.
So if we are not visible on cyberspace, how can fans find us? So I am having a whole lot of fun blogging, tagging, posting comments on articles that are written by people who are speaking about subject matters that I am speaking about. So recently I found out that Glenn Close, the actress Glenn Close, and I share the same mission statements. I am just so thrilled. So I'm blogging about her and her organization.
Have you written her yet?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm going to just keep on blogging about her, and then I'm going to, because I think she would be great as the psychotherapist in Love Made of Heart.
Right. So what I'm hearing here is finding the communities that exist, becoming part of them, and building your own.
Right.
I mean, okay.
Here's a really easy thing for everyone to do is when you take pictures and you're posting them on your website, your blog, whatever, don't post them up there as P100374. You know, have your name and an action verb, right? Teresa cheers for immigrants. Something like that. So that right away when my mouse is on your photo, I will see your mission statement.
More questions.
Hi, I had a question for Elizabeth. You said that you targeted bookstores nationwide and had a 16-city book tour. How did you specifically target them? So what steps? Did you pick up the phone? Did you write a press release and email them? What were the specific steps?
Okay, thank you for your question. First of all, just before I go into details, all of those things, as I said, I've been doing this forever, since I was a child. I've been obsessively writing and obsessed with, you know, wanting to get published and wanting to have a literary career. So from a very young age, I was just, I was researching everything I could about the literary world. Journals, bookstores, you know, what were the kinds of bookstores who would be interested in my work? What are the kind of places that I think an audience, there might be an interesting audience for my work? I've just always had this obsessive sort of relationship to literature in that way. And so I was, you know, talking to people and getting advice and also doing my research. And I targeted as many bookstores, mostly independent bookstores, because some of the larger bookstores would not even look at me because I didn't have, you know, I wasn't, you know, Henry Holt wasn't my publisher. But to me, actually, my favorite bookstores were all these interesting bookstores, like I was saying, Elliott Bay or City at Lights or places like, you know, where you find out where there are really good reading audiences, like Portland, for example, because all of the rain, you know, people, it's such a big reading town, right? You know, and so I really just in earnest searched, and I got the names of people. I also looked at all the sort of the the local papers and got in contact with them for press releases to promote the readings, and worked with people that I knew all over the place to help bring in an audience. And, you know, some people like hosted little wine and cheese things at the bookstore to bring in audiences, and different fundraising types of things that you know, I would also do. Or, as I said, I was a part of this sort of this community of people who were producing in the visual arts as well. And so I had that network. And so I'd find out about these series or you know, interesting venues that I could read, like at art institutes or something where I could pull in audiences there. And I really did my homework. I made phone calls. I called and called and called. I emailed, and sometimes I'd call several times and wouldn't take no for an answer. And seriously, I would not take no for an answer. I mean, then finally there were certain places I had to take no for an answer, but you know, you learn, you realize, and you test it out. And then, some people really appreciated that I was like that, and they said, great, we're going to do this, and we're going to work this out. And we set up the date, and I figured out a time period when I could do this tour. I did all of those things. Any way I could contact or find out who the names of the events coordinators are. And then they start coming to you, so that, you know, I had built up a mass of interest that people would start coming to me, and then it you know, it starts to get a little easier. But yes, any place you can find them. And I think it is good to talk in person still, even in this internet world, because sometimes they will hear, they won't hear, but try every possible way. And I did, and although I say I didn't try to make this a commercial issue, I did still have to write a little paragraph that was my pitch, sort of. I wouldn't say that it was I would say that I didn't follow the rules that one should probably follow to get their book out there. But, and as I said, I think I will follow that maybe more closely next time around. But I just, wherever I felt there was a connection. And also I do have this history of working in bookstores, so I contacted those people too. So that's what I did, and it's well worth it. Thank you.
Can I just jump in, because Elizabeth talked about speaking at City Lights. Bookstores are also like blurbs in a way. There are certain key bookstores that if you read at them, that will impress all the other bookstores.
Yes.
We're very fortunate to have some of those bookstores in this area. City Lights is one of those bookstores, the one in North Beach.
Yes.
It's considered kind of an endorsement of the progressive thinkers of the country. So if you can get your book on the shelf there, it's actually considered a coup. Even if you have, they only buy one book, people in the industry notice it. The other one around here is Book Passage, which is, they have one in San Francisco, they have one up in Corte Madera. It's so well regarded in the world of booksellers that if you can get an appearance there, it will impress somebody at Elliott Bay or Powell's up in Seattle.
Powell, okay.
So they all kind of know each other and are impressed by that.
Yeah, and the City Lights, you don't need to have a name. They respect self-published authors as well if they find it a really interesting project. And then after that, somebody at City Light invited me to take a Tai Chi class with other writers. And so then we were all doing Tai Chi together. Then you network, and it sort of builds.
Right.
And that's the community part, and the fun part, too. So.
You notice that Elizabeth and Scott both used the words connection, networking, right? Show up. Have fun. Show up. You know, when your favorite author's in town, go. Mm-hmm. Go meet that person. Mm-hmm.
Which is hard to do if you're a writer, because writers tend to be very, you know.
And say hello to somebody when you're there.
Right.
Exactly. Which is also hard.
And introduce yourself with your full name. Mm-hmm. The power of your name.
Yeah, this is for Teresa, actually, a bit of a follow-up to your last question. Do you find that you use the same techniques with self-publishing to build your consulting business with writers?
Yes, you know, building one's name applies to any industry, really, right? You have messages or a product or a service to sell.
Yeah.
So it's really important that you know your target audience. And, you know, I have to say again that for fiction and memoirs, your target audience are the people who are like your protagonists. It's really that simple.
Teresa. Or who they want to be like.
Right, right.
Teresa, this question is for you.
Yes.
Regarding the fact that we're talking about self-publishing, you just touched briefly on building your name.
Mm-hmm.
You've self-published something?
Yes, yes. You know, I like control. With, you know, when you sell the rights to publish to a third-party publisher, you lose control. You know, they have paid you. So they have bought the rights to publish or not publish, when to publish, how many times to publish. And if they decide that they don't want to do a second printing, that's their decision. Mm-hmm. And you have signed that contract.
This workbook.
Yes, yeah. The workbook, yes. It's really based on working with clients the last 2 years. It's when they came to me to say, my agent says, my publisher says, my agent says, the publishers are saying, I don't have a platform. I don't have a fan base. So I said, well, you know what? Let's spill. Let's spill right now. Let's not wait.
So did you have, just to follow up on that, did you have another question like, what did she do? Just take us through the process a little bit. How successful has it been? Who are you selling this to?
Ah, you know, I'm going to turn it
the
into an e-book.
The nitty-gritty stuff.
I'm going to turn it into an e-book because ClickBank, folks, ClickBank, mm-hmm, learn it from Linda Lee, that they have... affiliates selling.
Affiliate programs.
Yes,
right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that I don't even have to worry about getting my own affiliates.
Yeah. But what did you do? I mean, let's get to this book, this workbook. When was it published?
January.
Okay, so it's pretty new. So who are you selling it to?
To my clients, to anyone who has met me through conferences.
Is it available on your website?
It is. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Is it in, because it's spiral bound, it's probably not in bookstores, right? So how are you?
Now, keep in mind that bookstores, they take 40%, of course, right, of the
sometimes
cover price.
Sometimes 55.
Yeah. Now, you know, when we got published, it was like, oh, no, don't do this kind of binding,
right,
because then
there's no spine.
Can't see. Yeah. But you know what? You really want your book phased out. So, you know, the dream is to have bookstores order many copies so that they have to face you out.
But because are they doing that?
My audience, it's target audience, right? Either I can have this book available at bigger bookstores that have the publishing or the writer's bookshelves, right?
Right.
I mean, it's no good for me to, let's say, put this in children's bookstores or mystery bookstores.
Okay.
But I think my target audience is I need to do more. One of my mottos, it's reach out, not stress out. Mm-hmm. I need to do more reaching out to writers.
Okay. Elizabeth, you've got some more? Yep. Okay, cool. You have time? Go ahead. Yeah.
Would you comment about being reviewed in either local papers or niche papers? How useful is it in this day and age?
So can we repeat the question? How important is it to be reviewed in newspapers or niche papers or magazines or what have you? How important is it? Is it relevant today?
Yes. All of it, because in cyberspace, it gets online now, right? Whereas when I was published in 2002, really cyberspace was not booming. So I got reviews, and that was it. It was in print.
Look, I think that the reality is we're in a moment of transition. I think the traditional gatekeepers of the traditional reviewers blessing a book and making it a big hit, that's actually on the decline. We're actually seeing book reviews go out of business all over around the country in newspapers. But the ones that still exist are probably disproportionately now more important than ever. Mm-hmm. So if you can get a review in a newspaper, whether it's the Chronicle or the Examiner or certainly the New York Times, Those things actually are life-changing experiences, especially if it's a good review. I think where things are migrating is we're seeing a lot more real people reviews, websites like Goodreads and Shelfari, mm-hmm. And even in Amazon where people have been allowed to review. The kind of the citizen reviews have really risen in terms of their importance in helping build a platform. The truth is that if you want your book to break out into a huge mainstream hit, you're probably going to most likely require mainstream media attention at some point. What helps you get that, of course, are reviews. It's building consensus. We start with a nice review in Publishers Weekly. Publishers Weekly, by the way, people tend to look at that at other newspapers and say, well, we're going to review that book because of something that Publishers Weekly said about it that was interesting. So getting into those, Kirkus is another, I don't know if you're aware of these. These are kind of trade.
Kirkus is out of business.
No, they're coming back.
Oh, they're
business.
Coming
They've
back.
Been bought. Okay. So, but basically, those trade
See how
publications
fast it changes?
That do really early reviews actually inspire the newspapers to do theirs. I have no inside information about how the New York Times picks what they review, but I've been told that basically the editors there meet with traditional publishers a couple times a year and listen to what they have coming out on their lists, and they get to hear a pitch directly. You don't have that direct access to somebody like Sam Tannenhaus, who is the editor, so that's difficult. But you should put it out there. You never know. We had a friend, a guy, David Henry Sterry, put together an anthology, a nonfiction anthology about sex workers. And Sam Tannenhaus, who's a conservative guy, put it on the cover of the book review, and it became a huge bestseller, and now there's a TV deal to turn this into some sort of series. And that was from a very small publisher, not one of the big six, and somehow it just got under their attention. So get those copies out there. Spend the money on getting copies to the
That's
reviewers.
Right. Give your books away. Give them to reviewers.
I'd also add, and this is very important, and people don't tell you this, timing is critical when you get those copies to reviewers. You have a certain period of time. It's a 3-month time frame between when you need to get the review to the review publication and when your book is coming out. So you have to keep track of the timing of your publication date and when to get those books to the reviewers. And go for as many as you possibly think you can. Go for Sam Tannenhaus. Go for the small literary journal. Whatever you think you may be able to use. But the timing is critical.
Publishers Weekly will not review a book once it is out. So once it's been published, they will not review it. They have to get a copy of it 3 to 4 months in advance in order to possibly assign it to somebody to review. But if you don't get it to them by then, they will not review it.
And I encourage everyone to write book reviews. Books that you've read, go to Amazon, write reviews. One line, two lines. So that when if I'm a fan or agent, publisher, or someone looking for speakers, I'm going to Google your name. I want to see what you've been doing on cyberspace.
What kind of community?
And if you have an expertise in a subject, offer to review a book for the Chronicle or the Examiner, your local papers. They'll be much more likely to review your book when it comes out if they've heard of you.
Yes.
And if you've been writing reviews for them, they're going to have heard of you.
One of the mistakes that self-publishers make because they're paying for the books is to not give their books away or to be chintzy about it and say, oh, I don't want to buy 50 books and I don't want to just hand them out. Mm-hmm. Believe me, print 100 books, send them to reviewers, not just the top 10. Do the top 10. But I keep hearing people say, I did my research. Do your research. Figure out who you want these to go to. Figure out who you want to endorse them. And just say it's part of the cost of doing this project and get that book in the hands of the people who can comment.
And since I'll tell you one thing. Since I'm now on the incoming for people pitching story ideas, I will tell you this, is that if it is addressed to me, it says hello to me, I'm much more likely to read it. If it's generic, I won't.
Spell their name right.
And it's just not, and that's not an ego thing. It's just like, okay, this person really wasn't specifically thinking that this would be a good story for me to do. Mm-hmm. They're just sending it out to 1,000 media people in a generic mass mailing, and that's not really what I do. In fact, it's the antithesis of what writers and reporters do. They want to break a story to break a story. They don't want the same story that everybody else has. So find out who these book editors are. Address it to Sam personally, not to whom it may concern.
Okay, Paul, unfortunately,
Kevin, do we have time for one closing statement, each of us?
Well, I was going to say we actually have. Okay. Yes, we do.
We're going to go over time.
I was going to let you guys know that we're at about the time where we have time for one more question. But,
okay.
And we do have that question already.
I was afraid he was going to just shut off the
mics. Designated, and then following the question, you guys can make a closing.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
This is primarily for Kimball. Might be kind of hard to answer in 5 minutes, but with so many writers coming online to Facebook, Twitter, their own blogs, how do you effectively build an online platform?
Well, that's a really good question. It's really the ultimate question. That's why you're all here tonight, is how do we break through in all the noise? And there is a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. And part of it may be doing it yourself, which is why we're here tonight. I have a great example of a guy, a local author named Stephen Elliott. I don't know if you've ever read his books. But he just started a website not too long ago called The Rumpus. And it's I think it's rumpus.net. Anyway, it's a literary site, and they have fun stories about publishing and books, and it's a thoughtful site. Well, he's already amassed about 1 million clicks per month, or whatever it is, page views per month. That's amazing. So what he has done in a fairly short amount of time is he has become one of these gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. So if on his site he says, you know, here's a book that's really good and you should read it, if he does reviews of book, it's actually going to reach out to a lot of people. So he built his own infrastructure. I did some of that myself. I used to publish something called The Lit Guide, which came out every week, where I would look at kind of a preview of all the literary events that were happening in the Bay Area. And in a fairly short amount of time, with a lot of work, I had thousands of subscribers. So when I published my books, I could say, well, I'm previewing myself this week. I'm going to be at this place. I'm going to be at the Booksmith on this date. And people actually showed up because they had been reading this newsletter. So sometimes you've got to be creative and think about how to come up with your own platform. On Facebook, friend everyone who wants to be your friend. Put it out there that you're a writer. Talk about your work. Don't put any personal information up there that you don't want the general public to know. Make your profile public. So let be accessible to people and start building that base of readers as well. But you want to try different things. What's interesting is that it's the thing that hasn't been thought of yet that maybe somebody in this room will think of that will be the next breakthrough. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all looking at the iPad and saying, how's that going to work? Well, you know what? Nobody really knows. And it could be you. It could be one of you that figures out an app for the iPad that is just so brilliant that it draws attention to you and your work. So you want to be thinking about those things. And you do have to do the hard work of being on the social networks and promoting yourself and sending out those books. But look for that next idea. I mean, I don't know. If I didn't have a downstairs neighbor who worked at YouTube, how my life might be different. But the fact was that I was talking to a lot of people and saying, what should I do? What should I do? And eventually somebody said, here's what you should do. And it actually made a difference.
Okay, so we should do you guys each get 30 seconds to wrap this up. They can have a minute. Okay. I'm just concerned that, you know. Really? He's changing the rules on me. So don't give them as long as they want. Okay, fine. So just give us a final thought that either about your experience or what you think might be helpful to the folks in the room on marketing their books.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you again for coming and for just the interesting questions and conversation with the panelists here. And I just want to say something about the issue of fame and notoriety, because that's what you deal with when you're talking about marketing of a book. I think if one wants to be famous, then I think writing is probably not the field to go into, and everybody probably knows that. So if it's really about that, then I don't know if writing is really the best way to the best avenue for a platform. I mean, there are so many ways that, you know. I mean, it's a hard road. It's a brutal road. I mean, it's definitely a wonderful road, and it's worth the work. But I think fame can be a dangerous goal. And so when we talk about